This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Next time you're near the reference section in the library, you might notice a new edition wedged in between the Funkin' Wagnalls and the Farmer's Almanac. It's the story of an industry that is almost inescapable, no matter how hard we may try. Advertising. For the first time, the history of the industry is brought together in a hefty three-volume Advertising Age Encyclopedia of Advertising. 240 historians contributed to an effort that includes profiles of leading ad agencies, stories about major ad campaigns, and explanations of the tools and methods that advertisers use to convince us to buy things we don't need. Later in the program, we'll focus on the emotion that so much advertising engenders, envy. Joseph Epstein will join us to discuss the latest volume in a series on the seven deadly sins. But first, this century of advertising. All of us see it and hear it and read it. Does it work? And if so, how? Does it shape popular culture or reflect it? Is there one ad you've seen in your lifetime that you'll never forget? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's, 800-989-TALK. And we have an email challenge for you today. This encyclopedia needs a good slogan to drive it to the top of the bestseller list. How would you sell a 1,000-page tome that retails for the low, low price of only $380? Our email address is totn@npr.org. Again, totn@npr.org. And joining us now is John McDonough. He's one of the editors of the Advertising Age Encyclopedia of Advertising. He's with us by phone from his home in Chicago, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi there, Neil. Good to talk to you.
Why do we need an encyclopedia of advertising?
Well, I suppose different people might have different answers to that question. When the project was first presented to me, I saw it as an opportunity, actually, to bring together the histories of I saw it mainly in historical terms, and second of all, I saw it as an opportunity to bring together the histories of a whole series of advertising agencies that once dominated the field of communications, but through mergers and just simply the nature of the advertising business, which tends to be personality oriented rather than institutional, disappeared and went out of business. People in the business today probably, younger people wouldn't know agencies like Ruth Roth and Ryan. But this was back in the 30s and 40s, the fourth or fifth largest agency in the country. So I thought it was an opportunity to get these agencies on the record.
Now, you've worked on other books. How is an encyclopedia different?
Well, an encyclopedia, I talk about this in the introduction. An encyclopedia is really a kind of an instrument of convenience. It's not really a work of scholarship or original research. The idea of an encyclopedia is to bring together more or less established information into one conveniently available source. But what we found in fairly quickly in doing this encyclopedia is that a lot of the topics that make up the book had never really been researched before. And the resources necessary to do that research were very scarce and very hard to find, which made it difficult for us to find contributors.
And eventually, this led to the partnership with Advertising Age?
This led to the partnership with Advertising Age. I have been contributing to Advertising Age for about more than a dozen years, and so here in Chicago, I found it relatively easy to prepare some of these articles myself, because I had available the research resources, and basically the clip file of Ad Age. But other people out in the provinces didn't have that luxury, so it was necessary and very desirable to bring Ad Age into this partnership. And as it turned out, it was something that they were interested in becoming involved in.
How did you decide? Now, you're talking about the stories of agencies and institutions that made up this industry, but ultimately it's about the ads that they created. Which ones did you decide to put in, and which ones to leave out?
Well, the categories sort of more or less divide into several different groups. There are the histories of agencies. There are the story of various advertisers who hire the agencies. There are a handful of biographies of important, influential people in the field. And then there are a whole other group of essays dealing with the methods and the procedures and of advertising, and still more dealing with sort of overarching themes and ideas in advertising, research, and there's a long essay on blacklisting, for example, which was the subject of a PBS program last night, because the advertising agency business was very much involved in that.
But you're not telling me how you decided which ads to put in, which ones to take out.
What we did was I made up an original, an initial list of topics that I thought should be included, and that sort of became the basis, the target that everybody else could take shots at. We retained an advisory panel of about 20 leading people in the business from all areas of the business, creative directors, agency presidents, press, representatives from the 4A's, the American Association of Advertising Agencies, and other people with expertise in the field, and we asked them to look at this list initially and suggest additions to it, suggest things that might well be dropped from it, and out of that process we came up with the 550 or so entries that are in the book now.
Since so much of advertising, particularly the last 70 years or so, has been on broadcast radio or television, is there a videotape and a CD that comes along with this?
Not yet. It would be useful to have that, wouldn't it?
Just spell out the jingles there in the encyclopedia with the musical notation.
Oh yeah, that would be wonderful. A CD in the back of the book would be great.
Well,
it's a funny thing because listening to old jingles is like listening to old songs from the hit parade. They're objects of nostalgia because they were targeted at us with such intensity for a limited period of time that when we hear them 10 or 20 years later, they tend to bring that time back into very sharp focus.
John McDonough, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
And congratulations.
I appreciate that. Bye-bye.
John McDonough is one of the editors of the Advertising Age Encyclopedia of Advertising. He was with us by phone from his home in Chicago. And to see portions of the encyclopedia and the Advertising Age website, you can check it out at www.npr.org. And joining us now to explore the advertising industry is David Klein. He's the publishing and editorial director for Advertising Age. He's with us from our bureau in Chicago. Good to speak with you.
Thanks.
And Randall Rothenberg is also with us. He's contributing editor to Advertising Age, and he joins us from our bureau in New York. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil.
David, you oversaw the construction of this encyclopedia. Why does it need to exist?
Well, I think John was right. You can look at it a lot of different ways. It certainly has a professional use. If you're an agency looking to sell an account, you want to learn everything about that company and its competitors. And I think it also has, it is a encyclopedia of American culture and society also for the last century.
Hmm. Randall, advertising dates, I am told, back to Mesopotamian times. I can't read the cuneiform myself. But when did you decide to, begin? You have to pick a date, right?
Well, this book, the encyclopedia, I think, goes through most of the past century. It certainly delves back further because it talks about the history of some agencies that go back into the mid-19th century, which is really when we date the beginning of the modern advertising industry.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to Pat, who joins us on the line from Toledo, Ohio.
Hi, Neil. How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Good. It's good to get a chance to talk to you. It's interesting that I was just picking up this conversation as I was going to pick up my grandson from grade school, and I had just been wondering recently about a public advertising piece that I had seen back when I was a teenager some 30 years ago, and it had encouraged me actually to go back to high school and finish and get my diploma. And I was wondering, will those types of public advertising messages somehow be included, because I really wanted to say to whoever did that campaign, thank you. You really improved my life by encouraging me to go back to school with that little ad that used to run during the, actually, I think it was on public television because I used to watch a lot of Sesame Street babysitting.
Yeah, do you remember what the ad said?
Yeah, it was a kind of a forlorn look at a city street. and a person walking down, you know, a concrete jungle type of setting and trying to open doors, and none of these doors would open to this person. And the tagline was, a lot of doors are closed to you if you're not a high school graduate. If you aren't in school, if you are in school, stay there. If you're not, go back. And that encouraged me to go back and finish up my senior year. I had presently actually quit school, was staying home watching my children's, or my sister's children babysitting, and it encouraged me to go back to school and get my diploma, and then I've been able to go on and go into higher education since, and it really had a profound effect on me. I almost would love to get in touch with that agency and say, you did affect at least one person with that campaign.
David Klein, can you help us out?
I don't know that campaign in particular. There are plenty of entries in the encyclopedia on public service advertising and the Ad Council. I doubt that ad actually ran on PBS, of course, which, especially 30 years ago, was pretty strict about not taking ads. But I must say that's one of the best success stories of advertising I've ever heard.
It's interesting, you know, because Pat brings up a really interesting point, and that is that, you know, over the 50-year history of television network advertising, some of the most powerful advertising we've ever seen has been public service advertising sponsored by the Advertising Council, but all of that advertising was created by mainstream advertising agencies. If the listeners really search their memory banks, I think probably everyone will come up with, if you ask them their favorite cultural icons of the past several decades, one would, I think, undoubtedly be Smokey the Bear. Well, Smokey the Bear was public service advertising.
The Indian chief with a tear rolling down his eye.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, everybody remembers that, another public service ad.
And these were done by giant agencies like Young & Rubicam and J. Walter Thompson and McCann Erickson, people, copywriters, art directors, strategists, working pro bono on behalf of these organizations.
Thanks very much for the call, Pat.
And thank you, Neil.
Bye-bye. One of the things that you point out, Randall Rothenberg, is that advertising has played an enormous part in creating a lot of aspects of modern society. Broadcasting in its infancy, of course, the idea of radio was to sell radio sets. So it was sort of an advertising a meta ad in and of itself. But things like opinion research and market research, too, begin in advertising.
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely true that, to get a little academic for a bit, you know, the history of modern sociology really tracks the history of modern mass communications. The study of public opinion was based on the existence of mass media. George Gallup was the first PhD recipient from the University of Iowa's Communications Department, which was the first communications department in the country. It was started to do radio research. The same is true. Some of the breakthrough theories of understanding mass communications were developed by people like Frank Stanton, who was one of the founders of the CBS radio network, and then, of course, the visionary leader, along with William S. Bailey, of the CBS television network as well.
And if you wanted to continue to work there, you called him Dr. Frank Stanton. But anyway,
absolutely.
We're discussing the history of the huckster, a look at the advertising industry, and when we come back from a short break, we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Don't forget our email challenge to come up with a slogan for the new advertising encyclopedia. This from Eric Nisley, I guess. I would suggest this as an appropriate tagline for the Encyclopedia of Advertising. Hey, I got no reason to lie to you. He's only half joking. He writes, I wish I wasn't. In an age when marketing companies are hired to sell foreign policy, the formalized fiction of advertising carries far more power than it should. You come up with a slogan of your own. TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the history of the advertising industry and how ads influence and shape American culture. Our guests are David Klein, publishing and editorial director for Advertising Age, and Randall Rothenberg, a contributing editor to Advertising Age magazine. Of course, you're invited to join our discussion. Do you, the ads you see reflect your life and culture? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And if you'd like to suggest a sales slogan for the Advertising Age Encyclopedia of Advertising, you can send it to TOTN at NPR.org. Rachel Gross suggests the Encyclopedia of Advertising, the book that will make you thinner, smell spring fresh, attract the opposite sex, and have whiter teeth. That's not too bad, David, is it?
And no, that one's not bad at all.
All right. The image of the ad man is often that of the huckster, the high-stressed individual who works on Madison Avenue, which is also famous as Ulcer Gulch, the tough job of making pressured cells not much respected by the public. How much truth is there to that, Randall?
Well, I'd say there's no more truth in that today than there is about employees in any other industry. I think we could say that advertising was kind of the leader of the new economy, in that it became a haven of uncertainty and neuroses and questionability and rapid hiring and firing. It wasn't always that way, though. Interestingly, if you go back to the 20s and the 30s, advertising was really a bastion of intellectual elitism. Agencies like J. Walter Thompson were known as redoubts of Yale graduates. People went from advertising to the highest levels of society. One of the most famous agencies of the 20th century was Benton and Bowles. Well, Benton went on to become governor of Connecticut, and Bowles went on to become Undersecretary of State. I think I have that right. They both went on to high government positions. That was very, very typical. It was only really in the 1950s that advertising began getting tagged with this, you know, kind of bad reputation of, quick talk and hucksterism.
Let's get another caller involved. Tim joins us on the line from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi, Neil. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. Go ahead. You're on the air.
My question is, my grandfather, Pierce Johnson, was one of the early art directors for J. Walter Thompson in New York City, and also was one of the early presidents of the Art Directors League, of the people who were art directors for major ad agencies. And I wondered, does this encyclopedia cover any of that material, or are there other sources that are available that might give me more insight into that period of advertising history and the influence of the art directors specifically?
Any famous campaigns that your grandfather was associated with?
Well, this is by family lore, and I don't really have a clear knowledge of whether it's true or not, but it has been passed down, and he was doing this in the 20s and 30s and maybe before, that he was involved in the development of the original campaign for Aunt Jemima as a logo. And, of course, looking at that from the 21st century, I feel a little askance. Originally, that was a fairly racist image, but I know it was a major brand and a major development in advertising.
David Klein?
The art directors are in this. I mean, they were originally more or less work for hire. They were referred to a little dismissively as wrists, you know, for their drawing. And I would guess that changed beginning around the time of the Creative Revolution, or late 50s, early 60s, where art directors came to be, the equal of anyone else in the creative process and major powers in their own right in advertising. The Aunt Jemima campaign is certainly in the book in some detail if you want to read about it. That has been obviously a very controversial icon that they've morphed over the years to try to make it more acceptable.
Right.
Sociologically.
Was that originally a J. Walter Thompson creation, do you know?
Randy, do you know offhand?
I don't know offhand.
I could look it up very quickly, but I'll be shuffling papers all over here to do it. If you want to send me an email or forward it to, I can let you know.
Tim, if you'd like to send us an email at totn@npr.org, we'll forward it along, okay?
But let me give Tim some other tips, though. The Art Directors Club is still a thriving organization in the advertising industry.
I'm aware of that. I recently found a volume of theirs in which my now deceased grandfather had an article.
I see. And there are some great histories of art direction and graphic design and advertising. And I recommend looking up one or two of the books by Philip Meigs. I think it's M-E-I-G-S, but you should double-check me. It may be M-E-G-G-S. Uh-huh. And also one of the many books, and you can look on Amazon or elsewhere, by Stephen Heller, H-E-L-L-E-R. Those are great resources on looking up the history of graphic design and advertising.
I appreciate it.
Tim, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We've got another entry in our slogans for the Advertising Age Encyclopedia of Advertising, this one from Mike Booth. Here's the easiest way to sell an encyclopedia on advertising. The ad commercial would read or say, Encyclopedia of Advertising, limit two, no exceptions. Get James Earl Jones to do the voiceover and you'll have a record-selling book. All right. We'll think about that. The invention of radio was a huge event for the world as a whole, and not soon after we saw ads appear on this new medium. And here's an example.
The Jack Benny Program, presented by Lucky Strike.
Feeling low,
feeling tense.
These big words are common sense.
Smoke a lucky
to be your level best.
Smoke a lucky
to feel your level best.
Yes, to feel your level best. Smoke a lucky, because Lucky's fine tobacco picks you up when you're low, calms you down when you're tense, puts you on the right level to feel and do your level best. That's what fine tobacco can do for you. And remember, LSMFT, LSMFT, Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. So the next time you buy cigarettes, ask for the cigarette of fine tobacco, Lucky Strike. For remember, Lucky's fine tobacco picks you up when you're low, calms you down when you're tense, puts you on the right level to feel and do your level best. Yes, smoke a Lucky to feel your level best.
I'm just beginning to think that there are a fair number of people in the audience who never heard a tobacco or a cigarette ad on the radio before. How did the radio change the ad industry, Randall Rothenberg?
Well, profoundly. The introduction of mass broadcasting was not just one of the great changes in marketing. It was one of the great cultural changes that any society has ever gone through. In terms of marketing itself, it allowed advertisers to reach a national audience repeatedly through the day, much more cheaply than they could through print. After all, magazines, newspapers are by definition local. So you can't reach a national audience. You could just piece together local audiences. Magazines tended to be out for a month. The ability to go into a program, a single program, and then more programs through across a national audience repeatedly and giving that same message over and over again created a national mass audience and ultimately a global audience for some brands and helped create the concept of global brands.
Let's get another caller involved, and Andrew joins us on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
One of your guests mentioned the links between the history of advertising and that of sociology, which made me think about some of the modern social theory regarding advertising. I was just wondering if the ideas of critical theorists like Stuart Ewan or Gene Kilborn made it into the encyclopedia, or what your guests thought about those ideas.
David Klein, why don't you start?
There are entries on, I'm not familiar with those specific, the theories you're talking about, but there are entries on critical theory, modernism, postmodernism in advertising, and certainly advertising these days is going through a huge sea change in terms of how it reaches people and how it speaks to them, given that you've got an audience now of people who swim in a sea of advertising and are very conversant with all the cliches of advertising. So you almost have to do anti-advertising to lure them into whatever activity you want them to do.
Stuart Ewan is actually a very dear friend of mine, and Stuart, either on his own or with his wife Elizabeth Ewan, wrote several really important pioneering books on advertising history. One is called Captains of Consciousness, and he and I have kind of differed on the implications of one of his theories, but he's generally been accepted as correct on one. I mean, he talks about the development of advertising as a way of inuring the culture to industrialism. And in fact, that's been picked up by quite a lot of other thinkers and historians. Michael Shudson, who's at the University of California, San Diego, did a book after some of Ewan's earlier books in which he introduced the phrase capitalist realist art to describe the power of advertising. It's a public art form that accustoms people to the culture of consumption, which is really what capitalism is about in many ways.
Hmm. Okay, Andrew.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Let's go now to Brian, who's with us from Boulder, Colorado.
Hello, Neil.
Hi.
I'm hoping you folks remember this. Back when I was a kid in Vermont in the 50s, there was an ad that I thought changed everything. And it was sort of a harbinger of who leads the horse. Does the horse lead us, or do we lead the horse? And it was a Purolator oil filter ad where somebody was changing the oil filter in the car, and it turned out to be a woman. And that was such a shock in those days that everybody talked about that ad forever and ever.
Hmm.
And I thought it was sort of a, perhaps the beginning of a change in society.
Do you remember when about that was?
I would guess 59, 58.
Hmm.
And everybody talked about it. You know, look at that, a woman changing the oil.
I wonder if that's where they ended up getting Josephine the Plumber from a couple years later.
Oh, I remember that. Could be.
Anyway. Thanks very much for the call, Brian. Appreciate
sure
it. Interestingly, we heard the Lucky Strike ad earlier from the Jack Benny program, but that was also, about the emancipation of women. Of course, as Randall Rothenberg, you point out, of course, they were enslaving them to nicotine at the same time.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely true. But it is true that some of the... You see, advertising has to be in sync with the currents of the culture. That's the nature of selling to a contemporary culture. So, the suffragist movement basically had some of its earliest support in early tobacco advertising. You know, Lucky Strike was among the earliest advertisers to use celebrity endorsers. And those celebrity endorsers really ranged across the culture from, Babe Ruth, obviously a baseball player, mm-hmm. to Rosa Pons, an opera singer. So, that's part of what advertising does. In that sense, there's very little difference between that old Lucky Strike advertising from the 1930s that you played
mm-hmm.
and the most contemporary, hippest advertising on MTV today.
It's all in a continuum.
Yes.
Yeah, actually, Amelia Earhart was actually also one of their endorsers. So you find a woman... she was unusual as a aviatrix back then, and that's who Lucky Strike wanted to be associated with.
We're speaking with David Klein, publishing and editorial director for Advertising Age, and Randall Rothenberg, Advertising Age contributing editor, about the Advertising Age Encyclopedia of Advertising. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. An email from Kurt in Renton, Washington. A small point was called to my mind during the discussion, this being that there really was a time when advertisers, instead of buying the rights to a popular song, as is the practice now, would commission the writing of their own music for use in ads. Of course, there is a use for popular music in ads. As some wag observed, car ads have better playlists than radio stations do these days.
Yeah, the jingle business has really fallen on hard times. All the famous jingles that we could all sing... They're being almost completely evolved out in favor of licensing music and breaking new music. It's become a very big business in the ad industry.
We have an example of a jingle that I guess was transposed from another song, but rewritten for Coca-Cola.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Apple trees and honeybees and snow white turtle doves.
I'd like to teach the world to sing with me.
Perfect harmony.
Perfect harmony.
I'd like to buy the world of Coke and keep it company.
That's the real thing.
I'd like to teach
it goes on. David Klein, am I right thinking that was a song before and then an ad, or was it an ad and then a song?
I think it was a song first.
No, it was original.
Was it original?
Yeah,
okay.
It was original for Coke.
It was. That was about 1970, interestingly, about, you know, around the same time as the Whole Earth Catalog and the first views of Earth from space and the early stirrings of global capitalism, and Koch was sort of prey on that whole multinational, bring all the different peoples together to, of course, drink Coke.
There's a part in your in an article you wrote, Randall Rothenberg, about Alfred Sloan at General Motors, this back in the 20s, and he was trying to beat out Ford, who, of course, had the incredibly low price on the incredibly popular Ford Model T. And you write that he understood that the automobile industry's salvation depended on changing consumers' attitude. The auto had to be transformed from a low-cost form of transportation into a symbol of attainment, one that could induce consumers to continually upgrade. You say he invented planned obsolescence.
Absolutely. In fact, Sloan was Sloan did several things. One is, he took this failing car company called General Motors, which had been cobbled together from acquisitions of many other car companies, and created the system of multi-divisional management. He really invented the management of complex multi-divisional enterprises. As part of that, he had to create a reason for people to buy cars other than basic transportation. I mean, Ford saw this as a way of creating a product, a vehicle that would be a better horse. Sloan took the many products of General Motors and, in effect, segmented them. So he imagined the consumer starting in as an entry-level car buyer. He or she would buy Chevrolet and then would step up, and after a time would buy Oldsmobile and then step up to Buick. And then when you got really successful and really wealthy, you'd buy a Cadillac. And this would cause you to continually upgrade your cars. He called it a car for every purse and purpose. And a lot of modern are thinking about advertising over the years about appealing to people's wants and desires. Well, it predates Sloan. Sloan really helped turn it into an artful science. And I should add, thanks to Alfred Sloan, we have this program, because the foundation that he endowed, the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, is one of the sponsors of this program.
We call them underwriters. Anyway, I'd like to thank you both very much for your time today.
Thanks.
David Klein is a publishing and editorial director for Advertising Age. Randall Rothenberg, Advertising Age contributing editor. We have one final entry in our contest, our email challenge to come up with a slogan for the Advertising Age Encyclopedia of Advertising. This one from Sally J. Bright in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, and she contributes, ad infinitum, of course. That's a pretty good one. When we come back from a break, is advertising the source of envy? We'll talk with Joseph Epstein about his new book, which examines the deadly sin of envy, when we come back. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.